So this is the second part of our meeting. Like the last time, I would ask anybody that's interested, you can come up, you can ask. There are microphones on both sides of the room. You could come up and ask any question to any of us, and we'll be happy to answer.
So who's the first
that breaks the ice? Come on. Oh, there, Adrien.
Hopefully an easy one to start. Have you considered ways of moving us closer to the core mission of the university? For example, last year I went to the Bring a Kid to Work Day, where we got to move through the university and see the different research projects and academic units and be closer to them, which in turn helps us sort of work harder and support the mission of the university better with a closer understanding with what they do. Is that something we could consider on a larger scale for the staff?
I'm not sure I understand your question. Do you mean having visits or?
Yeah, having us go into the university community and see firsthand what it is that we're supporting.
Okay. I think that's a good idea. And one of the things we could leverage is at the beginning of the year, Ryan and CCS organize days where we go in under tents and in the classrooms and things like that. And maybe that could be a way where we could be manning the fort and asking people to go and meet with students, with new students. And so I think there could be ideas that we could think about.
Do you have ideas?
I mean, the tents that we do are typically tied to sort of homecoming or other sort of big events, the start of the semester, to sort of introduce, you know, new students and their family and new faculty to IT. But I'm not sure if that may be an opportunity to sort of reach out to the community and get a sense of what they need or what they're doing. But I guess what you're talking about is really sort of going almost like a sort of walk in my shoes or...
Yeah, I'd like to go see what the students or the faculty are researching and what they're working on and what it is that we are part of in terms of the bigger picture of the core mission of the university.
No, I think that's a great idea. I'm not sure how to accomplish that, but maybe Sharon.
One small thing is we have a standing invitation to bring anyone who wants to go see how our larger first year science courses are handled. So we can go and do that live. So if anyone's ever interested, I have a standing invitation to bring anyone who wants to go. So that's one small thing that we can do, and we can probably find some other research projects that aren't sensitive. Some of them are sensitive, and we just can't get involved in, but we can talk to researchers and find out what other kind of projects they have, and when they do a public sharing of that information, and go and see those as well.
Great, thank you.
I can tell you by experience, that's not necessarily easy to arrange. They are very, very busy people. So I think it's better maybe just to find out, because sometimes they have open houses, they have different things like that, and kind of get a sense of what's happening and just sharing that and say, oh, if you're interested, go and see this or go and visit that because it's available and it's open and it's... So let's say go into the classrooms... where professors have invited us, but it's always, we have to think that we cannot be disruptive either, so it has to be something that makes that can make sense for everyone.
Sorry?
Hey there, I was just gonna recommend maybe an introduction, like going around for an introduction for some of the new teammates, and there's a couple of people that I don't recognize.
Okay.
I mean.
Okay, so I'm Guylaine Roquet, I'm the CIO.
Sharon Roy, Director of Content and Collaboration Solutions.
Ryan Ortiz, Director of IT Customer Service.
Larry Tanzi in the very successful PMO, Project Management Office.
Hugo Dominguez, the new director of IT infrastructure, the NCS group.
Jacek Fabuszewicz, director of information security.
Brigitte Champigny, director of information system resources.
Et Lucie Carrière, HRIT.
It wouldn't really be an IT town hall if I didn't have a question. But I'll ask an easy one. We have a new principal. Have you met with the new principal? Do we think the new principal is going to change our direction, alter what our focus will be?
So, yes, I've met with her. We'd asked her to come here today. Unfortunately, she was already booked, but we'll try to get her for our meeting in April. Because I think it's always interesting for people to hear. So I don't think that she doesn't seem to be the type of person that will, you know, bring radical change. I think she may have a stronger focus on research because her research background is substantial. She is herself a very respected researcher and has worked more on the research side of things in her career. But what struck me when I met with her was that she has a very, very good understanding of what is a university. Even on the good sides and the less good side of what is a university. One of the things that she was telling us, because she was meeting with the more administrative staff, and I felt that was interesting, you know, sometimes we feel that what we do is constantly questioned, denigrated or objected to by faculty, especially from the academic side of the house. And we didn't bring it up, she did. And the interesting thing she was telling us is that you have to understand that it is faculty job to question everything. It's what they do. They are researchers. Their way of thinking is to put into question everything that is supposed to be established truth and verifying, is that really true? Is that really the way things are working? So that's their main makeup. That's the way they are. So we shouldn't be surprised when we do things and we feel that they take us as if we were incompetent or... No, it's just the way they are. The way they are is to ask questions. Is this really the case? Is this really true? And of course, they know better than everybody, but that's kind of a fault that comes with the quality that makes them good professors and good researchers. So I thought that was really interesting in that she had kind of thought about it and kind of seen that in terms of the difficulty of relationship between the service side of the house and the academic side of the house. I felt was really, really interesting and proved real insight. She's also, I think, a more calm? I don't know what kind of terms I would use, but sometimes, and maybe that's just because it was the end of the mandate, Professor Ede Bloom was someone that was really trying to do kind of everything before she left, so it gave sometimes a sense of being frantic and also pushing so many initiatives and so many things that it was kind of overwhelming. I have the impression that she's going to be more measured in the way that she does things. So, of course, there will be difference in focus, there will be some changes, but... I think that she is somebody that really understands the institution and wants to promote its growth and its recognition. I'd say, its influence in the way it's going to give to the world or to our communities. So I had a very good feeling. I liked her.
I don't mind. No, I don't mind.
Okay. There's time for everybody.
Okay. I was just wondering how the roles in new positions, if an individual's doing two of those jobs, then, and they're getting a new title, how does that work? Like, will they only be focused on one thing, or?
I think that the way it's built, the fact that we're reducing significantly the number of titles and that they're more generic, so they're not linked, let's say, to a specific technology or to, will make that kind of rare. I don't think there will be many instances where we're going to be, ooh, is that, so for example, I don't see someone that would be at the same time, let's say, a BA and a DBA. Or if there are instances, then I would say that we'll probably choose the main role that somebody is playing. But I would think that because we're reducing the number of titles, mm-hmm. I think that the chances of that happening will be lower, let's say.
So they would only be focused on one of the tasks? So if they were doing two or three tasks, then they would be focused on...
Tasks is something else. You know, if you look at a job description, it covers a lot of tasks.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
You have to understand that this is part of an exercise of reduction of resources. So we have 41 of our colleagues that retired, and we exceptionally got the permission of replacing 18 of them. So there's a net loss of 23. The 18 positions that we've been allowed to recruit are currently, they are posted, and we're currently recruiting. But as you know, recruiting is not necessarily easy, especially in IT these days. There's a rarity of resources. So we're doing the best we can. The other thing that's also an issue is that we have asked our friends in the user community to diminish the number of requests so that we would be able to have some time to do knowledge transfer. But that is not happening. On the contrary, we're getting more and more requests because they're in the same situation. They're losing a lot of resources, and in many cases, they have not been allowed to replace them. And, you know, their salvation comes from our work. So, because they want us to automate things that will reduce their workload. So, in fact, we're not getting less requests, we're getting more requests. So this is going to be a very, very difficult exercise to manage, and it is extremely worrisome. I know that a lot of work that has been done in all units to kind of identify ways of keeping that knowledge, but it is not obvious. I'm thinking, for example, of the people that are currently working on two huge projects on the HR and payroll side, the pension and the biweekly payroll. Those people are working like crazy. They don't have time to do knowledge transfer. So when they leave, we're going to be really in a bind because, you know, they're all leaving. That one is particularly worrisome. But we're kind of trying to do, I think, the best we can. In other cases, what we're doing to kind of mitigate that is that we're asking existing colleagues to share knowledge with the ones that are leaving, so that at least we get some internal people that have that information. But as I said, it's not necessarily easy to organize in a context where the workload is immense. It's really, really big. So I'm kind of very worried. I'm worried for us. I'm also worried for our colleagues, you know, the ones in all the other units. When we get to January, that's when it's really going to hit us because, you know, some people left in August, but a lot are leaving in January. And I think that's where everybody's going to feel the pain. And I think it's going to be very, very painful. You know, those people were not idle. They were not doing nothing. They were all working. They were all working hard. So they're leaving, and it will show. We will feel it. We will see it. There's no way that's not going to happen. So I know that's not a very, very satisfying answer, but it's the reality of it. I don't know if somebody else has... Brigitte, yeah, in her sector is particularly...
So... Just to say that the recruitment process is going. I mean, there's a lot of work that's being done. I see Alexandra, who's here today with us. She's doing a great job helping us on that. She has a lot of work. So it's not that the recruitment is not going on. It's going on. Of course, we had for some position a lot of internal candidates. Which we're still, the process is still going on. Of course, it's going to be good if we choose internal candidates, but it's going to free position again. So we're still going to have vacant position after. So having said that, in regards to knowledge transfer, as Guylaine said, in some areas where we know we are losing a lot of resources, unfortunately, even if we had new hired, I don't think we would necessarily have the time to do knowledge transfer. We're trying to do more documentation. In other areas, there is knowledge transfer that is happening more globally toward the rest of the team. So I'm looking, for example, in the student portfolio, there's already a lot of activities going on in there. So like Guylaine said, it is worrisome, but... There is a lot of activity going on. The managers have been engaged in participating into the recruitment. It was also summer. It was difficult. It was a period where it was difficult to get everybody together to do the interviews and things like that. So the other thing also, again, for HR payroll, one of the message we're sending to our users is that we will probably require probably knowledge transfer from them to us, because there's the whole business part that we can do knowledge transfer on the system and things like that, but when we have people that have been there for so many years knowing, you know, the business, this knowledge is not something you can acquire, you know, overnight. So we are trying to sensibilize also our users that we will go to them for some of the knowledge transfer. So they may have, when we have the new people coming in, they may have to sit down with them and explain things that they would not have had to explain to the current employees. But so they understand. Of course, they are stretched also on their side, so it's not going to be easy either. But Norm?
Things will go smoothly for the implementation of those two. I guess in my case, as with some of the others, I'm perhaps more concerned about pension than HR payroll.
I cannot say that the dates were predetermined without consultation. I mean, there was consultation in terms of what work needs to be done. It was not necessarily easy to evaluate the amount of work that was needed. You know, how much time did we need to do this? At what point we had provided some estimates that, you know, once we knew more, we had more information, turned out to be higher. So on the pension, I cannot say that the timelines are very, very, very aggressive. And if we had had only one of the two projects, I think we would have been in a much better situation. The problem was that we had those two projects together. In terms of payroll, the biweekly frequency, this is not something that you can really move the date. It had to start at the beginning of the year for many reasons. So it's not something we could say, okay, we're going to start in February. The payroll had to start on January 1st, 2014. So this is something we didn't have much choice. This project, however, had been we had known with this for a long time. In fact, that was supposed to be implemented for January 2013 initially, and because of some issues with the union, it was pushed to January 14. I agree that the planning of it and the defining of what we mean exactly by biweekly frequency started late in the game, and that's also where we had, you know, some issues. So, like I said, I think one or the other, we would have been fine. It's the two together that's the problem, because it's exactly the same people that have to work on it. And that's where it's very very difficult. We did add some external resources. We have a consultant working with us, which on that area helped. But that's the case. So, and those dates were even established before we knew about the whole retirement program. Retirement program was announced in April, and those projects had already been, you know, planned and looked at. So, like I said, it's not the best circumstances that we have now.
I think the first thing we did is that we still got approval to hire 18 back. I think that's already something, because the conversation was really interesting when we had it. Was well, why would you rehire? The idea is to reduce the workforce. So, well, you know, I'm losing 100% of payroll in HR. Do you really think they shouldn't be replaced? And strangely enough, that they saw reason. And no, so we did get that's already exceptional. I think we're the only unit that got approval for significant rehire of staff that left in that program. So that's already one thing. The other thing I think is kind of a continuous battle with our users, and I say battle. I think we have good relationship with our users. I think and they understand what we're living, but they are also living difficult times. So it's kind of a tug between you know, them seeing our reality and recognizing that reality, but at the same time have a very important needs. So I think it's more of a of the discussions and the work we're asking them also to do in terms of better prioritize, better have a sense of what's really essential and what's essential and what is not. And that is something kind of new to them, to kind of have that reflection and think about it. But it is an ongoing work. We've been at it, I'd say for nearly a year now, that we've been really bringing them to do better planning, to have a better sense of what should be worked on. And I'm not saying that it's perfect, but I think it's getting better. But there is conflict. There is, we are often not on the same page, and what is reassuring, though, is that they do understand. They're not necessarily reasonable, but they do understand. But I think it's going to be very, very difficult. So the best we can do is kind of be a buffer, so that, you know, the battles are done at our level and not at in the trenches. But many times, you know, you feel the consequences. When we talk about pension and biweekly, the people who are currently working on that, it's not easy. Like it wasn't easy for GAP. You know, you've been, you know firsthand how hard that was. So we have to get better. We have to have more information. We have to have discussions with more facts on the table. So that's one of the good things of what we're currently doing in terms of recording and getting real information in our discussions with our users. But the best we can do is just kind of put ourselves in the front and try to push back as much as we can. At the same time, recognizing that their needs are real. So we have to recognize that too. So it's not easy. We're going to live difficult times. Not only us, but everybody at McGill, I think. It's going to be very, very difficult.
Maybe something about budgeting or forecasting, improving the way in which we evaluate how much effort it's going to take to do something?
Well, yes. And also, here's an example of what I mean when I mean having better discussions with our users. Recently, when we were talking about GAP, the user community was under the impression that they had significantly reduced the scope. We were able to demonstrate that it was not the case, that the scope was still higher than what it was initially. It was controlled, but it was higher. So when you're able to bring back discussion to reality, instead of you know, people think the way people perceive reality, and when you're able to bring reality. Another good example is that the change of priorities is an issue. We start working on things, and suddenly priorities change, and we drop projects that are not finished, and we start working on something else. We waste a lot of time doing that. When the time is not recorded, you may know this, but you cannot make the demonstration of it. When you are able to demonstrate, it really brings the conversation at another level with your users, because you're able to say, hey, if you hadn't shifted all those priorities, we wouldn't have wasted thousands of hours working on things that we didn't deliver. Or at the same time, they have to recognize their own capacity. That is also an ongoing discussion. You have to realize that we develop code, but they have to test it. Before it can go into production, it has to be tested. It has to be, you know, user acceptance is essential. So there are cases where we develop code and it's sitting in QA and it's waiting. And they do not have the capacity. So it's not bad fate. It's not that they don't want to. They just can't. They don't have the time. So they have to be also realistic on their own capacity and what they are themselves able to do. So that's also part of the discussion. And the work that we're currently doing to be able to have a better sense of how much work goes into something helps that discussion, because we're more realistic. We're you know, they you know, the kind of a magic vision of, you're telling me it's going to take 3 months. No, 1 month. No, it won't be 1 month. It's going to be 3 months. And we're able to demonstrate it. So I think that it's all that. It's discussion. It's having those conversations. It's having better information, better clarity, better transparency in our discussions, so that we're more we're on the same page. We share the same information. That's the only way we're going to get somewhere. But there's no magical solution that we can put in place, unless somebody here. has the want.
Just a question. Would you say it's fair to say then that we won't be engaging in activities that aren't adequately funded?
Well, we are already doing that.
Is that something that we should be taking a serious look at and sort of evaluating whether or not we should be still doing those things?
But we are doing that.
Right.
Now, currently, there are things that we've refused. There are projects that we've refused to start, that we've refused to work on because we didn't get the funding. So that's already happening. So instead of, so there are cases where we're currently not appropriate. Things have been started, but they are not appropriately funded. I think, for example, for BI, BI is a real issue. We're going to have to kind of think of how we're going to manage that, because currently we're not getting the proper funding for those projects, and at the same time there's huge demand. But there are many other instances where we have refused and we have put projects on the back burner because we just didn't have the funds. It's the case for the CRM, it's the case, non-credit course was in that state for a while, and finally Judith Potter got funding, so we're going to go ahead with that project because now we have funding. But we are doing it more and more. We're really evaluating the real costs and deciding on that, saying, well, are we able to do it or not? And I'm very clear, you know, all my numbers are on the table. We've made presentation to the deans, to the VPs, to everybody, showing exactly, you know, what money we were getting, how it was used, and, you know, if they want to make change to those allocation, they can, but we cannot create money, and we cannot create capacity, and we cannot create projects out of thin air, you know. So this is already happening, that saying that we're not going ahead because there's no money. And money is resources. In-house resources is also money, because if they're working on this, they're not working on that. We don't have ubiquity, any of us, so that's pretty much it.
A little bit more along those lines. So you talked about a lot of change and being quite overwhelming, and obviously we're all aware of the amount of change that we've gone through in IT services. And in the way we also deliver IT solutions. What do you feel the impact has been on our users and our clients, and if that poses any risks going forward? As you mentioned, we have certain conflicts that we're faced with, so we tackled one aspect where we have shortage of resources, but also the way we use our resources in delivering our solutions, the perception that they have, do we understand what it is? Do we understand how they feel about our solution delivery process and what we're doing right now? So that would be my question for you.
So I think that depends. Some units are more understanding in the sense that they're trying to do something very similar in their own activities, so they kind of see what we're trying to do. Other unit less so. And I think that in some ways it goes like not having information or not having accountability is very comfortable. You know, if things are kind of saying, but it's whenever, and 8 years later projects are not finished, you get the sense that nobody told you no, but in fact we aren't delivering. But it's not obvious. Accountability is another issue. I'll give you an example that was really interesting, and I'm not pinpointing there because it could happen in any unit. But I had a conversation recently with Kathleen Massey, who is the registrar, and she was telling me that you know, she met some deans, and they were frustrated that some of their demands were not fulfilled, that we hadn't answered them. And what I told her was, well, Kathleen, I don't understand why you're telling me this, because with the coordination committee, you are deciding the priorities. So if they're not being done, it's because you decide that they're not a priority. It was an interesting moment. And as I said, I don't want to pinpoint Kathleen in any way. She's an excellent partner. But that's what it means, you know, when you're saying, okay, now, you know, prioritization is going to be done by user groups. They will be the ones deciding what is more important. Well, with that comes accountability. And what we're seeing, other examples where, for example, in CCS, when they're working with their coordination committee, they don't want to make the decision. They're frankly saying, no, 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 I don't want to decide. You decide. And then I can blame you. So, you know, it's interesting. So, yes, you know, you're going to hear things like, and I think that's one of the things that we should be doing to help, because sometimes people don't measure what they're saying. So I've heard things like, you're only putting in those new ways of managing your projects to be able to delay them. Of course not. You know, really. That doesn't make any sense. That's not what we're doing. And I think that they may not realize that the impact that saying something like that can have on us, in the sense that make us feel you know, incompetent or meanful or something like that. So, but at the same time, when we're able to show them and start giving them information, and ourselves being more organized and seeing the impact, for example, we I don't think before GAP we ever measure the contribution of people in NCS, but also a lot in Katrina's group, the application servers and admins. Those people are absolutely essential. They do critical work. There are not many of them, and you know they're completely overwhelmed by the work that has to be done. And people don't see that, and we don't take their capacity into account in many cases because our planning was poorer. So now with better planning, we're able to see that, we're able to measure better the impact and maybe make sure that we have proper capacity at that level too, not only at the people who are developers. We want to be able to reuse. We want to be able to kind of have a better environment in terms of development. But for that, we need documentation. We need to record. There's an initial effort that is substantial. Anything that you put into place, there's a learning curve. And we may be IT, but we also have a learning curve. And that's what we're seeing. What we're seeing, though, also, is we're starting to see example of things where we're starting to see the benefits. So I think that, you know, you've all seen, you know, those graph of a project where you have the Valley of Despair, and, you know, there's this moment where you're not productive anymore because the way of things, everything has changed, and you're not comfortable yet with the new ways of doing things, and you're saying this will never work, we will die, and your productivity goes down. But at some point, you start to see, you're starting to see the benefits. You're starting to see some things that are coming out of it and say, oh, this is good. So the information that we now have, being able to say that we worked 34,000 hours on GAP, and that's not, it's a big part, but it's not all, but it's much better than when we had no idea. To be able to have discussions in terms of what is the real cost, what is the real effort that is linked to a project, I think is a plus. The work that is currently being done by Sue and Aurial and Larry in terms of integration of all our methodologies and starting really how they integrate and how they gel together, we're starting to see examples of that, and something that I would like us to present at the next town hall is really fun. We're starting to say, oh yeah, that's interesting. And we're starting to see the benefit of it. So it is the Valley of Despair, and unfortunately it is combined to an unforeseen event, which is the departure of all those colleagues. That was not planned for when we started the process, and it doesn't help, because it creates another important learning curve. But on the other hand, if we had not started those projects, I don't see how we would have managed to reorganize our activity just to be able to absorb that loss. So, yeah, it's a small silver lining.
Can I just pursue with one more question? So if we take, for example, the School of Continuing Studies, which have now unlocked their own funding for a project, how is it that IT services will come in and help them support that implementation? And how much control do they have over internal IT spending versus external costs in the end, if they're in control of their budget?
No. You don't understand. We made the budget.
Okay.
We gave them the budget they needed to be able to do that project, and they got the approval. We will get the budget, and we will manage the project. So just to be clear.
Okay.
But it raises an interesting point. I always find it very strange when I find myself in the office of the provost or in the office of Michael DeGrappa asking for funding for projects that are not IT projects. We are not the ones who will be getting the benefits. The benefits are going to be in HR or in enrollment services or in the faculties or somewhere, but not in IT. IT, we get the work, we get the spend, the costs, but we're not getting the benefits. And so why am I there defending those projects? I find that very weird. And I find it strange because normally in any organization I know of, it's the business that's defending their project and getting funding for their project. It's not IT. So that's kind of weird, and that's also something I think that we're starting to push back on and say, well, if you're not even able to go and sit and defend your project and get funding for it, why should I? You know, what's the value of it for you if you're not even willing to do that? So that's an interesting point. So in that case, Judith Potter felt that it was important. We had asked for it. It was in the roadmap. It was we required funding for it. We didn't get it. She felt it was really important. It was essential. She's been asked to augment her activities significantly and to do more and more and more because she's bringing revenue to McGill, and that revenue is required. So, but she needs tools. She needs to have ways of doing that will be reasonable, that will permit her to do those additional activities. So she felt strongly about it, and she went and she got the funding. Well, I think that's fine. But we will be managing the project. She won't be managing the project. We will be doing it. But she justified it from a business perspective, and we provided her with all the information on what was required to do it. So we'll go ahead.
I just want to go back to one part of your question about how, with the business, how are the business seeing what we're doing? It's not easy. I think you're facing that every day. Right now in your project, we are very, very conscious of that. And are they on board right now? I would say not all of them. It's easier in some area than in others. It's a big, 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 big change. And it's a big change for them. It's a big change for us. And I just want to raise a question. I don't want an answer, but I want you to think about it, is that are you yourself even convinced that we are doing the projects the right way? Because I cannot say, Guylaine is talking about, acquiring the knowledge. It's all new for every one of us as well. And the benefits are not the way we were doing delivering initiative before and the way we are delivering initiative today, the results doesn't come as fast now that it used to come before. And very often what I see, what I perceive is that, because if you look at it in the end, if you look at what you deliver in the end, not what you deliver in between, but in the end what you deliver, a complete solution that fulfill all the requirements of the users, if you look at the time that it takes to get there, I can assure you that it doesn't take more time the way we do it today. We're trying to do it now than the way we were doing it before. Before, we were delivering things faster, but not complete. Not complete, why? Because we didn't know all the requirements. So we were delivering against something that, for the requirements we knew, and then they would come up again and say, well, now we want this, and we're like, yeah, but it doesn't fit with the solution. If we had known before, we would have made it differently. So we always have a little bit of rework, you know, that is going on, and that is that we say, oh, the project is finished, we have delivered. But in evolution, and I'm sure every portfolio manager sees it, and all of you sees it, is that after that, in evolution, we continue working and working and working on this constantly. This removes capacity on our side to do other stuff. And in the end, like I say, maybe not now, because we're not yet mastering the way we deliver projects. So now, is it equivalent? No, we probably take more time now. But as we get better in it, I can assure you that, like I said, for the exact same result, it's not going to take more time. And hopefully, and I also believe in that, the quality of the solution in the end would be better. So we are very conscious, you are facing in your everyday work a lot of resistance from the users. We know about that. I'm really not ready to back off. I think we should continue doing that. We as managers are going to address that. Like Guylaine says, we have meetings with the users. We try to sensibilize them. There's area we have more difficulties. We are going to address that. We have to explain, you know, to them the difference, explain more. We have explained it, but, you know, that's not easy. That's the kind of thing we have to repeat and repeat and repeat again. And like I said, we have to master ourselves as well. So it's going to take time, but like I said, don't be discouraged. I don't think we should back off, because this is something that has been successful many, many, many places. So I think for the better of the university, we should continue. And we're going to support you on this.
Other questions? I think next time I'll ask Richard to do it. It'll be more fun. That's all?
I'm going to ask a question. Once upon a time, IT was seen as a strategic service, and we reported to the provost. And then several years ago, it was decided that we were a cost center, which kind of gave us the notion that, okay, we're a cost center. It's not strategic to the mission anymore. By making us a cost center, we now report to the same vice principal as the unit heads for HR, payroll, finance, all of, at least ISR's customers. Therefore, if there is conflict, it's obvious it's going to find its way to Michael McGrath's office. So I'm just wondering if that has happened yet, but what it sounds like you are sent out to try to appease them as opposed to him as the figurehead to resolve that situation. I wonder if you could comment on that.
I'm trying to get my head around what you're saying. I think there are two things there. The first one is in terms of reporting structure. You're right. IT was moved from under the provost to under Michael de Grappa. I think one of the main reasons was at the time because the load of responsibilities around the provost was so huge that it was kind of seen to kind of reduce his workload. The other thing that was really important was that there's still a dotted line. I report to both. So people may not necessarily realize that, but I do have a dotted line under the provost, and I meet with him regularly. And I was also, I am also invited in things like the provost meetings, the APG, things like that. Unfortunately, though, they're all cancelled because he has too much work to do. So that link is still there in terms of reporting structure, and in sense of realizing that we are intrinsic to what everybody does, as much on the academic side as on the service side. So that's one thing. The other thing is that I get very good support from Michael de Grappa, and he does participate in all discussions, but I think it's normal that I would be, you know, kind of leading interventions around IT. You know, he same way Lynn Gervais would do it for HR issues. So we get very good support from Michael. I think one of the areas that have been difficult is the kind of tension there is because budget reports to the provost and finance reports to Michael. That is also a significant issue in terms of managing allocation of resources. It creates kind of a strange situation, but that's the way it is. So I wouldn't really I wouldn't say that we're not getting support from Michael. We are getting, and he is part of that discussions. And P7 also, we made presentation at that level, and we've had discussions at that level. So I don't think anybody thinks IT is not absolutely essential and crucial. You know, nowadays nothing happens without happy IT. It's kind of strange, but it's the way it is. And we were discussing, I don't know if all of you are aware, but there's currently a huge, not failure, but anyway, a crash, system outage at UCAM. And they're going to be at least 2 days without network, without systems, without nothing. I think that's going to be a very educational experience. So that's the silver lining. You know, when I hear that IT is not important, I say, okay, can we close for a week? And everybody says, no, of course. So I think sometimes, though, we become, we're so there, we're so everywhere, that we become invisible. People just don't realize how absolutely essential we are in what we do. And at the same time, the demand that we get kind of shows that. If we were not that important, you know, nobody is doing the queue at facilities to ask for more electricity. We've got it, it's there, okay, fine. But nobody is there saying, oh, I want electricity, give me electricity. But we have tons of people that are lined up saying, I want more IT, I want more systems, I want more this, I want more that. Everybody wants more, more, more. So I don't think that means that we're not relevant. I think it means that we're very, very relevant. Too relevant.
I wasn't saying that you're less relevant than you were. All I'm saying that is that we're just as relevant as the HR units and the finance units. And I hear that. I mean, I work on the shop floor, and I hear those frustrations day after day after day now. And I'm wondering when that's going to bubble up, because they all essentially have the same boss. Those people have to deliver as well. They have performance dialogues, you know, which they're going to be judged upon. And if it has an IT implication, then they can't deliver and reflects on them. So I hear that frustration every day. And I'm just wondering, I mean, I'm not saying that that's somehow.
One thing you may not be aware of is that all our partners, so I mean AVPs and directors and they're all pushing for us to get more resources. I think that you may not realize that, but they're all doing it. They're all asking for us to get more resources because they recognize that currently we're not able to meet their demands. So I found it, you know, it's always interesting. When you look at the budget for some units, they say, if IT has proper resources and funding, this is what we're going to do. And it's a big if. So And they are pushing. I've seen them in meetings. I've seen, so a lot of them, they're saying, cut anywhere, but don't cut in IT. On the contrary, you give them more. So you may not know that, but they are seeing that, and they are asking for that. At the same time, there is enormous demand everywhere. I wouldn't like to be in the shoes of who's doing the arbitration between all those requests, but I suppose they're doing the best they can. But you're right, they're all tied.
It's just an idea of mine that might help a little bit. So I agree with what Brigitte said, that it's better that we collect the requirements more completely at the beginning, and I'm seeing it in my job that we didn't have the requirements clear enough in the past, and it's better that we have more complete scenario testing. But this is taking longer, and it's adding to all the frustration that everybody's mentioning. So if there could be a process, at least for some of the smaller items, where it was recognized that the unit that was requesting the change could make do with 70% or 50% of the change being delivered right away and not being held to all of the requirements being met immediately, because if you take an analogy like a telephone bill needs the taxes better expressed and six other different things. Maybe the taxes one is the most important, and even for smaller evolution items that aren't big projects, if you could define them all but deliver them bit by bit, it might help with the frustration.
Well, where I agree with you is define them all and then deliver them bits by bits. The problem is that that's not what's happening. What's happening is that we have people that tell us, oh, you tell us that this is going to be 6 months. I want it to be done in a month. So I'm going to say, oh, that's not what I want finally. I want something else. And deliver that in the month. And then you come back and you say, well, really, I wanted the whole thing. But the way it was designed and the way it was built, then you have to scratch it and you start again. So the problem is you need to have the whole of it. Then we could, yes, have an approach where we deliver by increments, you know, more of an agile type of delivery model. I think that would be really interesting and is something that we have discussed. But if you think, well, that's a learning curve also. But the thing is, if you don't have the total vision of what will be required at the end of the day, you do not build it properly. You do not design it properly. You do not do it properly. And what happens is that you're constantly scrapping the work you've done and starting again. That is significant waste. So it is frustrating. And in a way, it shows that our users themselves don't really know what they want. So sometimes we get that sense of they haven't been used to really think of what they really want, what's really important, how things should be. So they think more in terms of solution than in that they think of requirements, and that's a big problem. So they bring solutions that are often inadequate, that are not, you know, a real solution to the whole of the problem, because the problem has not been defined. So yes, I think it could be a very interesting model where we would get the whole of requirements, but then deliver by increment. And it is an approach that is used in many, many instances, many companies. But we still need that first step that is so hard to get to, where we have to define those requirements. What exactly are we asking for? And that's part of the learning curve. And as I said, we have a learning curve, our users too. And for them, they have a lot of difficulty giving us that information. It's something new for them. It's like when we talk of benefits. It's also something that's new. You know, people are used to have a model where they're getting benefits, however small they are, and they couldn't care less about the cost. But from an institutional perspective, this is wrong. This is really, really wrong. And that's happening a lot, where we have units that come, oh, I'm going to be able to save $100,000 a year. Well, that's very good, but if it's costing $5 million, it's not worth it. Go on spending the $100,000. So that discussion also is also something that has to happen and wasn't happening at all. And I can give you tons of examples where we're spending much more than whatever benefits the system is bringing. So I don't know if that answered your question. Where is she? Oh,
she says, yeah. Hi.
Can I go ahead? Hi. One thing, actually, before I ask my question, I just wanted to observe something I thought was interesting, the fact that ITS is and has been losing 41 people, and UCAM is down, and they've only lost one. So I don't know. You can draw from that what you wish. No, I just figure that I don't think it's possible to gather all the requirements no matter what, because just putting in a system or a part of a system or whatever changes what you're looking at. It's like I think I'm, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you put in a new system, the next day you're going to get, oh, if only we could have had it this way, we should have had it this way. It's the user experience that will change. You know, there's that interplay between the system and how people are using the system. People will come up with new ideas based on the fact, well, now I can do this. Maybe we can do this, change something else. Sort of a Heisenberg type of thing.
So you're right in a way. It's kind of the blank page versus having, you know, when you do a prototype of a report, suddenly people tell you, oh, I want this column and I want this subtotal, and you're right. So, but it's one thing to say that things don't evolve. Of course they'll evolve. Nobody is going to build a system that will be, you know, stuck in time forever. That's very different than saying, have you properly identified the problem? What are you trying to address? If you don't know that, maybe you'll forget some aspects of it, and maybe you'll want to add additional things. But fundamentally, are you addressing the issue? Are you addressing the problem? If you are, that means your system is scaled properly, it's built properly, and it's going to be easy to make it evolve and make those type of user experience adjustments. If you didn't get that, then your system is worthless. You'll have to start again. And that's the big difference. I think that you're right, things change in time. But basically, is the system scaled properly? Is it working properly? Is it doing basically what it was purposed to do? And then can I make it evolve? Or is it totally beside the track and I have to start again? And if we haven't addressed at least understanding what the problem is, initially we're trying to correct, there's good chance that our design is not going to be appropriate.
Yeah, I'm just wondering how if the design of a system and the solution that you are aiming for really are the same thing, if you know what I mean. I mean, I think you could design a system to be more or less flexible. A methodology and things like that. So I like the idea of, you know, a methodology that's always going to be scalable and flexible and robust. And I realize it's true. If you are just patching up something to make it work because you didn't realize at the beginning that you were going to need something else, I guess also what I'm driving at is the fact that, I mean, it seems that people are looking for certainty, and certainty requires information, and information is money.
Hmm. You're right.
So I think you will always be dealing with a certain amount of uncertainty, and I think one has to accept a certain amount of waste in order to progress. I think there always will be misstarts and mistakes. You try to minimize it, that's all.
Yeah, I agree.
you try to minimize it. That's, I think, the point.
I just want to make an analogy, and Sue, excuse me, I'm going to use one of your, one of what you said lately to one of our, some of our user community. We had a situation where they were asking for something which was pretty big, and when we told them it was pretty big, they said, no, 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 that's not what we want, it's much smaller. And we, you know, it went around and around and around and around, and at one point, and I'm going to use what Sue said, she said, okay, are you telling me that you want a bicycle? And they said, yes. And are you telling me that you're always going to be happy with your bicycle, that in 3 months from now, you're not going to ask for a car? And they said, well, no, in 3 months from a car, we may, 3 months from now, we may want a car. So what Sue said is that a bicycle cannot become a car. However you want to put it, it will never become a car. So if you really need a car, we need to know now. Because what we're going to put as a solution is not going to be able to evolve where you want to go. So they said, okay, fair enough. We want a car, but we want a Lada, not a Mercedes. Perfect. That's what we want. But the situation is that because we told them, this is big, they thought that, you know, automatically they needed to reduce their requirements. But that's not that. The requirements cannot really be reduced. They are what they are. It's the solution we put against those requirements that we can adapt.
On the other hand, sorry.
Sorry.
On the other hand, if you deliver a ladder, they will need a bicycle.
Well, yeah, you're probably right. And that goes back also to what Jane was saying in terms of, you know, gathering the requirements and delivering piece by piece. It's exactly what we should be aiming at. But in order to do that, you need to know the whole thing. So you need to know they want a car. And, you know, you can, well, a car might be difficult to deliver piece by piece. A house is easier, but anyway, so that's what we mean when we say gathering the requirements. And of course, maybe at this point, the color of your car doesn't really matter to us, okay? But we need to know that you have a grosse roulotte, you know, that you want to bring down to the United States, and it has to be the power to be able to do that. You know, that's the kind of thing that we are looking at.
Thank you. See you next time. Oh, no, she's running. Oh, my God.
So we've just built UApply, brand new system. How does that fit in terms of our evolution, new projects? What would you see as the lifespan for UApply? What kind of evolution should we be doing on it? Would we have a new project to do a massive upgrade? Under this new framework, how do we see something like that evolving?
Okay, so if I listen to my users, and I'm not, phase two of UApply is undergrad admission. Let's take a break. Let's do that next year. Not this year. I want us to, you know, I don't know if all of you realize that, but one of the reasons that we chose Groovy on Grails to start that new development framework was that Banner is going to use that framework to develop their new versions of their applications. So we wanted to be kind of in tune where they were going, but also because we recognized that using Banner as a development framework was not maybe the best way to go, that we needed a development framework as it is. And we've built UApply because the functionality that was required to support graduate admission
was not available in Banner. It was not something that they had something, but it was not what the users wanted. So we built that application, and we've built a lot of integration. But in a certain sense, we're kind of moving to an approach where we want some decoupling. So we've customized Banner extensively. It makes it extremely difficult to upgrade and very costly. Having an approach where we're more modular, we're decoupling functionality, we hope in time will give us more flexibility in terms of evolving and answering the needs of the users. But we still basically are, you know, we will be, when possible, if possible, using software already existing. Software, so either a Banner or other packages that we may find. So we don't feel that we need to reinvent the wheel, especially for processes that are well known and are well covered by existing applications. But we will need what I think is what we're seeing is what we want is integration. And that is probably the area where the most work is going to be done. If you look at UApply and you look at the architecture of UApply, there's a lot of systems that are integrated there. You know, we're integrating with Banner, but we're also integrating with Documentum. We're using CAS. So there's all sorts of technology that are brought together to build the solution. And I think that that's going to be something that's going to be happening more and more. We're going to kind of want to build links between application. The BI, from our perspective, when we're looking at it from an architectural viewpoint, is also something that we want to use that way. We want to be able to use it as a way of sharing information between applications. So not only, you know, providing information to the users, but also internally providing information from system to system. So that's kind of the vision where we're kind of gradually starting to see kind of a more of a seeing all our different application and system not as discrete, independent blocks, but something that starts to look more and more as a cohesive combination of technologies. So as I said, GAP was a first in many, many things. We did not do everything perfectly. I think that if we would redo that system, let's say in 5 years or in 10 years, it would be significantly different. But it is bringing forth ideas that are really interesting in terms of saying, okay, we have a system to store documents and to manage documents. Let's not build another one. Let's integrate with it. We have another system that can manage authentication and access. Well, let's use that. Let's not rebuild. So more time trying to tie in different things. So that's where I see something like GAP as an example. In terms of evolving, it will evolve. As I said, before we do a second GAP, we'll give ourselves a break. We'll try to kind of master that one, finish it properly. But at least now we're seeing it and it's functioning. It's answering the load. We're not getting too many problems in terms of user requesting support. That's pretty good. On the whole, what we're getting back in terms of feedback, users are happy with it. They feel that, and we now have programmers that have participated in building it that really know the environment and that are able to build with it and share knowledge with their colleagues. So it was a hard lesson, but it's a fruitful lesson. But in terms of evolution, we will probably be building those types of conversion blocks that will be kind of linking things together. We're not going to become a big development shop, you know. It'll still be more localized type of things than big development. So let's try and keep our idea of using things that are already done instead of having to redevelop or recreate worlds. So I don't know if that answers your question in terms of GAP per se.
I'm thinking, you know, Banner, we upgrade every hadn't really evolved that over the 10 years or 12 years, because every time it upgraded, the ours was independent of that, and so it was staying static and not stale. So what is our point to do about it? Do we just let it become stale and then replace it as a whole unit, or do we keep evolving it, not just for new functionality, but to make the functionality that it has keep up with the times? Whether it's upgrades to Rails and the structures that underpin it, or just for use.
Well, that we'll have no choice to do because we need support and we need a code that is secure and everything. The difficulty there is that it's difficult to do that. It is costly. When we think of the last banner upgrade, there was not that much improvement in terms of functionality. So yes, we upgraded the environment. It was technically more robust and more up to date, but from a functional viewpoint, there was not a lot of change. We were not giving much more to our users, and it was still a $8.5 million project, so it's a lot of money. So that's a difficulty that we have to maintain current in terms of technology, and that's costly. And when we customize, we put that, we make that more costly also. So it's kind of a balance, trying to have approaches where we can decouple sections and upgrade some and without upgrading others. But in time, we have to think about the evolution of everything. So that's kind of the evergreening planning that we're currently preparing, making sure that all our technologies are evolving and that we're able to make them evolve with as less impact and cost as possible. It's not always obvious to do that. Sometimes it is very complex and very, very costly to do. And you're right, one of the areas where we really need to work on is web, portal, all those interface, Minerva, et cetera, is an area where we really need to focus on. But one of the problems we've had is that the level of customization we've made to those environments make them very, very difficult to upgrade. And I think that has been a kind of a break. So it's kind of a mixed bag of difficulties. But we're trying to move to an approach where we would be reducing the cost of upgrading and changing technology to be able to focus more on delivering functionality instead of delivering technology. Because I think that has more value for our users.
Everyone here, down to a person, is facing really challenging times. And of course, it's the nature of our job. It's about change. We always have to keep, on the ball. But in order for change, in order for us to deal with that kind of constant change, certain things need to remain constant. And we need to feel reassured about certain things. And I know it can sometimes be hard to see where we're going to be in a year or two. But I think deep inside, everyone has a need for stability. And my real question is, do we have an idea of how long we have to deal with all of these changes and all the demands that are being placed on us? Because, of course, there's quite a few people who are taking on extra jobs from people who are leaving their units and stuff like that. What is the time frame, and that is my question, or do you anticipate how long it will take before we can, shall we say, find the dust settling and
normal?
Yes.
Be normal.
Oh, sorry.
Deal with that or be normal, madam?
I know. just an idea of how long. I mean, because I'm sure we've all gone through this at one point or another. It's IT, it's, do we imagine it's going to take maybe a year or two? Because then at least we know, okay, how, how long is that?
So, yeah, if I had a magic ball, the answer to that. Frankly, I don't know. And
you know, I could tell you. So, if we look at it initiative by initiative, I can tell you when I think. So, for example, the introduction of new methodology, new ways of doing things. I think in a year or so, probably a year and a half, we'll be pretty comfortable with those things, and it will be much, much better than it is currently. If we're thinking of reorganizing our work following the departure of our colleagues, then again, probably 2 years we'll be in control, and that will have been absorbed. The difficulty is not so much what is the time frame to address the issues that we currently have. It's what else is coming. You know, we have no idea. And what we're seeing is that we're in a world of where there's a lot of change. So I know that's not a very comfortable answer, maybe not the answer that you would like to hear, but realistically, you know, I think that what we're currently facing, I think we're doing everybody, and there's a lot of work that's being done to address it and to improve the way that we're going to manage following those things. And I think that, yes, in an horizon of a year or two, we'll say, oh, yeah, that's done. But there'll be something else. Mm-hmm. And that, I don't know what it is going to be. Mm. Yeah, but there'll probably be something else.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
There's a question here.
Okay, last one.
It's a crazy idea, but back in the days when McGill started doing IT, the retired people, they know about that. McGill used to develop software and then sell, like give outside. We spent a lot of time, like I've been working on the applied and all the 34,000 hours. Is there like an idea of maybe selling it, partnering with somebody? Like we're using it, I don't think we're that different of a university. Is there like a... We have a lot of customization, but there's a lot of things that we all share across other things. Is there a way that we could reuse that time we spent there?
We share a lot. For example, Sharon could talk about the sharing we do with the Drupal environment. So when we can, we share. In the case of if you apply, it would be difficult. Though there are probably some things that we could share. And we did share the GPA calculator when we did the prototype with Drupal. That was shared. The difficulty is that it is fine-tuned to a very specific environment. It integrates with Banner, with our customization. It integrates with Documentum. So if somebody else is using whatever else, it'll be more difficult. So they're part. So it's not obvious to see which part of it could be reused. But I'm laughing because we saw a presentation from a university where they did their undergrad, their graduate admission system, and it was much, much, much less costly and complicated than what we did. But McGill is unique. We have a lot of very, very unique requirements. And yes, other universities seems to be managing their processes in a much simpler way than we are. And they are managing to do systems much less complicated than ours. Let's say for you apply specifically, there may be part of it that we could share, but as an application, it is so interlinked with other technologies, I don't think that would be realistic to think that at another university would have the same combination as we have here for that specific application. But when we can, we do. We do share a lot. There's and I think that's a characteristic of university on the whole. We do share and exchange a lot of code information, documentation, all sorts of things. That happens on a regular basis, yes.
Makes it difficult to share it with others. But when it comes to Banner, you mentioned the customizations we've done and how it makes it difficult to apply upgrades, the additional costs involved. But is it not possible that the customizations that we've done were not at the whim of a user, but it was because, well, there are certain things that made McGill unique and they had no choice if they were going to go with Banner. They couldn't water down their requirements, that they have to have certain customizations made.
Frankly, I don't know. I know that there's nearly 1,000 customizations in Banner. I don't know either if the way it was customized was the best way in terms of... So I'll give you an example, and that's not a student example. It's an HR example. We've customized HR a lot. And doing that, we have broken the functionalities that permitted decentralization of functionality. Because we were centralized when it was customized, we felt that it was not important to maintain the integrity of the tools that permitted decentralization. So they were not taken into account when we customized. And now we're not able to decentralize HR. And that means that if we wanted to do so, if we wanted to stop, you know, shuffling paper all across campus, we would need to re-implement from scratch. We couldn't even upgrade. We would really need to start from zero, re-implement the application, and then re-look at all the customizations we've made and see, okay, now do we still need this? Is it still required? And how are we going to do that with a decentralized use of the application instead of a centralized one? So that's also sometimes an issue. If we fine-tune, but we do it in a way that doesn't that does not provide for eventual change, the accumulation of all that makes it a very unwieldy block of code. And then brings the difficulty of doing the upgrades because it has frozen the environment as it is and becomes extremely difficult to make it move to another version. So, but I wasn't there, so I'm telling you things that I've seen specifically. So I don't know about other the student or the financial side of it, if the damage is as big as it is in HR. But there are ways of doing things also that have impact on the long term. So this was a very, very, very application-centered town hall. Thank you all for coming. Too late.